Greetings and welcome to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. On today's program, we'll have a report on the 28th Annual Assembly of the Organization of American States held in Caracas, Venezuela, where the primary focus was how to make the OAS more effective in dealing with the region's ills. Then we'll hear from correspondent Emilio Pantojas about the sale of the Puerto Rico Telephone Company and the growing movement to have the sale stopped. Later we'll talk to the parents of North American activist Lori Berenson, who's been serving over 2.5 years in a Peruvian maximum security prison. And finally we'll talk with the president of the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia about Occidental Petroleum's announcement in late May that they were not going to drill for oil in the territory of Colombia's Uwa people. All of this and more are coming up next, but first here are some stories making headlines this week in Our Americas.
With news from Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal. The Cuban government is refusing to comment on a U.S. newspaper report that a small group of Cuban exiles had landed secretly on the island to foment armed resistance to President Fidel Castro's government. Foreign Ministry spokesman Alejandro González told reporters in response to questions about the article in the June 4th Miami Herald that he had, quote, absolutely no information to offer on this subject. The Miami Herald said that a small band of exiles belonging to the Miami-based Movement of Revolutionary Recovery, or MRR, slipped into Cuba last week to begin anti-Castro activities. The report quoted MRR sources as saying the exiles, led by 73-year-old Ernestino Abreu, had landed on the northern coast of Cuba's western Pinar del Río province. False rumors of such landings have been common both on the island and among the Cuban exile community in Miami. But Latin American and European diplomats in Havana said they had also heard reports from people in the zone of a possible incursion and of heightened military activity in Pinar del Río. Some people living or traveling in Pinar del Río in recent days also said there was an unusually strong Cuban military presence, including extra road controls.
Meanwhile, the Clinton administration says that an agreement between the U.S. and the European Union would ease trade sanctions against companies doing business with Cuba, but would also hit the island's President Fidel Castro. Undersecretary of State Stuart Eisenstadt told a congressional panel on June 3rd that the administration will seek approval from Congress to waive a provision in the sanctions that denies U.S. visas to foreign executives of companies that do business on expropriated U.S. property in Cuba. The agreement requires congressional approval. The chairman of the House International Relations Committee indicated any administration legislation to ease Cuban sanctions may be dead in the water.
The Mexican government's crackdown on Chiapas continues. Hundreds of police raided an opposition-run village in the southern Mexican state on June 3rd, firing tear gas canisters and detaining 147 people. Most of those held were freed later, but justice officials said about 16 detainees were held longer. About 400 police stormed the village of Nicolás Ruiz because the opposition party of the Democratic Revolution, PRD, that governs the town, had expelled a number of pro-ruling party families. Villagers battled police briefly with sticks and stones before scores of residents were led away to police vans. A government official said the raid followed a request for help by the state branch of the government-run National Human Rights Commission, which was worried about the fate of the families. State police and troops raided several pro-rebel townships in the area that declared autonomy earlier this year. The region has been polarizing for months as whole villages divide into pro-Zapatista and pro-government supporters.
Also out of Mexico, some Mexican officials knew all along that the United States was investigating money laundering in the country's banking system. Contradicting earlier accounts that Washington left it in the dark, Mexican justice officials acknowledged on June 3rd that some officials were aware of the operation, although they did not approve of it. Senior Mexican officials were stunned by news of Washington's 3-year probe, codenamed Operation Casablanca, when its results were announced at a bombshell news conference over 3 weeks ago. Now, Mexico's Attorney General's office is saying some of its officials had in fact been informed that Washington was tracking money laundering, although they were not told of an undercover operation. Operation Casablanca was the largest ever U.S. crackdown against laundering of drug profits from the Mexican and Colombian cartels.
An independent audit of Guyana's presidential elections 6 months ago found no evidence that fraud had contributed to American-born Janet Jagan's victory. The report, released on June 2nd by a 7-member Caribbean Community CARICOM team, said its recount of the more than 400,000 ballots cast in the December 15th vote varied only marginally from official results declared by the Guyanese Elections Commission. Those results gave Jagan more than half of the vote, but were bitterly contested by her chief rival, former President Desmond Hoyt, sparking several days of violent street protests and looting in the capital of Georgetown. With the political future of the former British colony in the balance, the CARICOM team brokered in January an agreement between Jagan's People's Progressive Party, CIVIC, PPP Civic Alliance, and Hoyt's People's National Congress, PNC, for an independent probe of the election results. The cross-party agreement also called for constitutional reforms to pave the way for fresh elections within 3 years. The 77-year-old Jagan is the widow of former President Chetty Jagan, who died in office in March 1997. She was elected for a 5-year term. Both parties had agreed to abide by the findings of the CARICOM audit. Hoyt has, until now, refused to recognize the legitimacy of Jagan's presidency.
U.S. President Bill Clinton and Brazilian leader Fernando Henrique Cardoso were expected to discuss recent nuclear tests by India and Pakistan, drugs, and Cuba in a June 7th Camp David meeting. The leaders of the two most populous nations of the Americas were due to meet on the eve of a special meeting on the United Nations General Assembly dedicated to drugs. Spokespersons for both leaders said they will address the future of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty following last month's nuclear weapons testing by India and Pakistan, as well as the turmoil on international financial markets, which has hit Brazil hard in recent months, as well as the visit last week of Brazilian's foreign minister to Cuba. Cardoso was in Washington to attend the signing by the World Bank of an agreement to fund education in Brazil. Next week, we'll have a full report on the International Drug Control Conference at the United Nations. And those are some of the stories coming out of Latin America this week. For Our Americas, I'm Sarah Gill.
And I'm Walter Krockmal.
You're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In other news this week, the Organization of American States wrapped up its 28th annual assembly on June 3rd, providing few answers to the region's most pressing problems while raising many questions about the organization's overall effectiveness. Correspondent Von Martin was in Caracas, Venezuela for the three-day session and has this report for Our Americas.
Mario, the three-day 28th regular session of the General Assembly of the Organization of American States ended early Wednesday afternoon, with Caribbean foreign ministers expressing their understanding and support for Trinidad and Tobago's situation in the wake of the decision that government announced recently to withdraw from the OAS Inter-American Convention on Human Rights. The support was stressed at a press conference and given by Caribbean delegations held at Caracas, the Venezuelan capital, moments after the assembly ended. The Trinidad and Tobago Foreign Minister, Ralph Marage, had addressed the assembly about the issue, explaining his country's rationale, which has to do with upholding the death penalty. He got the support of his Caribbean colleagues present and some Latin Americans as well.
I should like to make it clear that the government of Trinidad and Tobago, and this is very important, the government of Trinidad and Tobago is prepared to continue to examine this matter should it be possible to adhere to the convention with such reservations as may be appropriate to meet the requirements and the concerns of the government of Trinidad and Tobago. This having been said, Mr. Chairman, I wish to underscore that Trinidad and Tobago is fully aware and intends to fulfill all of the obligations which devolve upon us from the Charter and the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. And finally, Mr. Chairman, let me say that I am sure that all my friends here, all our friends in the hemisphere, will agree that the record of human rights in Trinidad and Tobago is an impeccable record. We have been a practicing democracy for as long as we have been a nation. We have political pluralism in Trinidad and Tobago. We change governments regularly. In fact, between 1986 to now, we have changed 3 governments by free and fair elections, transparent democratic process. We emphasize economic democracy, mobility of our population. There is the rule of law in Trinidad and Tobago. There is separation of powers between the judiciary, the executive, and the parliament. There is a vibrant media in Trinidad and Tobago. And I want to repeat that which you already know, so that you will be able to understand this action that we have taken in recent times to separate ourselves from the American Convention on Human Rights in order that we may be able to carry out the law of Trinidad and Tobago.
So that was the Trinidad and Tobago's Minister Ralph Maraj as he described the situation of his country in order to remove itself from the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights. But what was explained actually was that although the country, the government has chosen to do that, it will still remain subject to the Inter-American Convention as long as it is a member of the Organization of American States. Because of the charter of the OAS, the government of Trinidad and Tobago will remain subject to the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights. So, and this is for all countries. Now, the ministers addressing the media corps were Mr. Maraj, Mr. Ruhi, and Mr. Hilton from Trinidad and Tobago, Guyana, and Jamaica on the question of Cuba, the Caribbean position calling for constructive engagement rather than isolation of Cuba was certainly explained and went into. It was described that Cuba, as a member of the Caribbean community, has its right to be a part of the organization, and this was indicated. Now, the St. Lucian Minister of Foreign Affairs, George Odlum, signed a hemispheric convention against illegal firearms, hailing it as being in line with his country's own internal laws. He said they do not impinge on or derogate from the principles of state sovereignty, judicial equality, and non-intervention. Mr. Odlum spoke of the provisions of the Inter-American Convention against the illicit manufacturing of and trafficking in firearms, ammunition, explosives, and other related materials. This was a very historical General Assembly in the sense that it was not really a session where you had ministers speaking for 20, 30 minutes at one time standing on a podium. It was much more of a dialogue where people came up and they spoke on their expressions while sitting, and it was much more of a dialogue, an intersessional dialogue, where people talked on the topics that was of tremendous concern to them. Now, the question of nuclear waste and toxic waste as it passed through the Caribbean lanes was one certainly that was brought up in a resolution and was unanimously passed. And Barbados Foreign Minister Billy Miller, whose passion to prevent the larger countries passing nuclear waste and toxic waste through the lane was made evident. And amidst right now of a confusion where it was discovered that leakage of toxic waste through the lane was made for over several years, and right now it's a big problem taking place in Europe right now as this revelation was made.
Nuclear waste in its raw state moves from Japan through the Panama Canal, through the Caribbean Sea, to France and the United Kingdom for processing, where it is vitrified and then returned for storage to Japan. I'm very concerned, as are my colleagues, that in the event of a spill, the damage is incalculable. We're accustomed in the Caribbean to natural disasters of all kinds, hurricanes, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and so on. And we know how to recover from them, and with a little help from Mother Nature, we do. But if there were a spill, or even a rumor of a spill of nuclear waste, I shudder to think what damage it would do, bearing in mind that we live and eat out of the Caribbean Sea. It is critical to the tourism industry in this region, and tourism is the major sector of most of the economies in this region.
And that was Billy Miller, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Barbados. The resolution was certainly passed, and it now becomes a part of the whole Declaration of Caracas, as the General Assembly has concluded. And that's it for the 20th session of the OAS General Assembly. This is Vaughn Martin reporting for Our Americas.
And you're listening to Our Americas. Another important development of the past week is the sale of the Puerto Rico Telephone Company. Labor leaders in Puerto Rico are angered at the privatization of Puerto Rico's government-owned telephone company and have organized a series of protests in a last-ditch bid to derail the sale. The pro-statehood governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Rosselló, announced in late May that the government had agreed to sell Puerto Rico Telephone Company in a multiple-step deal that will generate over $1.8 billion for the government of the U.S. colony. This includes the $375 million that the GTE Corporation is paying for a controlling stake. Governor Rosselló said the deal was necessary to keep the company competitive.
The rule in our administration is that we have to utilize the resources of the people of Puerto Rico in its most efficient and effective way. The resources that are at the disposal of the government are not do not come directly from heaven. They're resources of the people. So it's our responsibility to use that and maximize its efficiency and effectiveness in terms of the common good.
Hearings on legislation to approve the deal were held throughout the week, but union leaders, worried about job security, announced a massive demonstration for June 6 on the steps of the Capitol, kicking off a series of island-wide protests and perhaps later a strike. Joining us now to talk about the sale of the Puerto Rico Telephone Company is Our America's Emilio Pantojas of the University of Puerto Rico. Emilio, it looks like your predictions about the island reaching a boiling point, which you made a few weeks ago here on Our America's, are coming to fruition, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Unfortunately, my forecast seems to be developing or evolving in the way that I foresee, and it's not a difficult thing to foresee it. I mean, there is the selling of a telephone company and the uncertainty that creates for the workers of the company. There is unrest at the Waters and Sewer Authority. Yesterday, in fact, one of the main gates of the main dam, Carraízo Dam in Trujillo Alto, busted a chain, and there was a crisis, a short crisis, but a crisis nonetheless, where three towns appear were threatened with floods from the spill of the water in the dam. There are almost every week one or two riots in the prison systems. There are disputes in other government agencies such as the University of Puerto Rico, the Electricity and Energy Authority. So it is not difficult to foresee that this is going to be a long, hot summer, to coin a phrase, I suppose.
Now, the main issue, of course, in these last few days has been the issue of the selling of the telephone company. Now, you heard Pedro Rosselló earlier referring to the efficiency and the need to for the state to rid itself of the responsibilities of managing these institutions like the telephone company to make them more efficient. Maybe you can give us, for our listeners, kind of an overview as to whether or not the Puerto Rico Telephone Company was indeed inefficient and inoperable in terms of the state.
Well, that's not true. The company, in fact, was a very profitable company. I think the figures everyone is seems to accept, the union, the government, the legislature, is about $100 million in net profits over the last two or three per year over the last two or three years consistently. So I fail to see that a company that it's making $100 million a year is an uncompetitive, a public company. There are some issues about the number of people employed per lines, and there's a ratio there that I don't remember the exact figures now, where Puerto Rico seems to be higher than the average company in the United States. But that has to do a lot with the economies of scale, with the fact that we're an island and that there are a number, the population is limited. We don't have different markets where we can expand in a company that belongs to the government. So there is that issue. But the company is not inefficient. In fact, one of the few companies, the few public companies that really work in Puerto Rico, if you compare it to the Sewers Authority, the telephone company is in good shape. It was making money, rates were coming down, and they were competitive. The question is that there is a gospel of privatization, and the government has not been willing to negotiate. I mean, the government assumed the position that it was going to privatize, appointed, the governor appointed a committee to negotiate with the different companies to take bids for the company. And in fact, they wanted to sell the whole company. And no company wanted to buy the whole company. So any company wanted to buy 51%. All of the companies that bid, neither of them wanted to buy any more than 51% of the shares.
Now, I must point out that we tried on Our Americas to get a representative of the Telephone Workers Union, but because of their organizing, their lobbying in the Capitol, and also the protests that they've been planning, they were very difficult to get a hold of. I did speak to Alfonso Benitez of the Central of the United Workers in Puerto Rico a couple of weeks ago about it, and he talked a little bit about it, but maybe you can shed some light on the position of the workers, of the telephone workers, vis-a-vis the sale of the Puerto Rico Telephone Company. What are some of their concerns? What are some of their demands about the sale?
Well, one of the main concerns, of course, is job security. There are rumors, and it is not unusual that companies, private companies, tend to trim all the fat, and the fat may be people on the verge of retirement, so they want some guarantees on the issue of retirement. They want some guarantees on the fact that the unions will be recognized. They want guarantees on retirement systems that are in place, those kinds of things. But what they are most concerned, of course, is the fact that when you privatize, the interest of the Puerto Rican people takes a backseat to the interest of transnational profits. And there is that concern also that ultimately the telephone company was a private company for a long time in Puerto Rico. And it became privatized when it wasn't profitable it became a public company in 1974 when it was not profitable for AT&T, which was running it at that time. ITT, which was running it at that time. And then the government took it over. And so now that the company is back on the black, they want to resell it to the private sector. And people are concerned that this is not good for the country. And indeed, it is not good for the country to subsidize private companies when they are experiencing losses, and then when profits come by, give it back to them. It is a problem. It is indeed something that needs to be discussed at the very least, and the government refuses to discuss.
Yeah, Emilio, maybe you can talk a little bit about that, get into the psyche of Pedro Rosselló, because he is, and I think that's one of the criticisms, again, that Alfonso Benitez of the Central Workers of Puerto Rico talked about, that he refuses to talk about the deal, that he's just, you know, as you pointed out, has this gospel of privatization that he's moving on, and he will not talk. It kind of is reminiscent to somebody here in New York, the mayor that we currently have here in New York, Rudolph Giuliani, who carries out his policies without worrying about what other people say. He just goes ahead and does it. What can you tell us about Pedro Rosselló? Why is he taking this approach, especially with such a delicate matter?
Well, I guess, I don't know about the psyche of Pedro Rosselló. His psychiatrist, I'm sure, will have us to tell a lot. But the one problem I see is he got a million votes. And he's the first governor in history that got a million votes, mostly because of demographics, no? But he won with a solid majority. He was the first governor since 1980, I think it was, to get a 50% plus majority. Everyone had won before that, between 1980 and 1990, in fact, with a plurality, 48%, 49%, but never 50% plus. He got 50% plus. He got a million votes. He has total control. The New Progressive Party has total control of the legislature, both the Senate and the House. So he feels emboldened. He feels that he can carry out his reform agenda. The only problem is that in his platform, in his campaign, he never talked about, or anyone in the party, in the New Progressive Party, talked about privatizing the telephone company. So he does not have a mandate. He claims he has a mandate. And since he claims he has a mandate, he doesn't feel he has to talk to anyone. He has created, his administration has a style of ruling by the press, of ruling by decree. They don't ponder, they don't talk, they don't want to hear anything that it's not what they have in their minds. The only problem is they didn't put everything to a vote, so they're making decisions that are not part of a mandate. They are constructing, they are pushing the country to a corner, Like I said, another example of this style of government is the prison system. There is almost one or two riots every week in the prison systems because they are trying to change the way the prisons are run, and the prisoners are resisting. The inmates are resisting. So that's the problem. That's the style. It's a style that we're here, we run the country, we're going to run it well, we're going to do it. The problem is they don't have competent people doing their job. They have people who are arrogant, and they are simply acting unilaterally. Eventually, this is gonna have a high political cost for them.
What are the unions doing to try to put a block to this sale? And is there any potential for actually succeeding?
I think that first of all, there are hearings now in the Senate and the House on the contract that is going to be signed finally between GTE and different parties. And who bought small, minority shares. But I think that the initial strategy is to every day during lunch hour between 12 and 2 more or less, there is a large contingent of workers from the telephone company plus other workers that join them and students and citizens protesting, a rather substantial, strong protest in front of the Puerto Rico legislature. There has been a vote, a strike vote, taken and approved by the telephone company workers. There is going to be yet another national demonstration, which would be the third since October, in which there will be probably a full-day general strike, a one-day general strike. And eventually, I suppose, if the company is sold, you would probably see acts of sabotage. You would probably see a general strike of more than one day. And you probably see street demonstrations. So that is what lies ahead. And will that persuade GTE to pull off of the deal? I don't know if there are clauses for them to pull off once the deal is signed. But if the deal is signed, I think that the sabotage is going to be very costly. I don't know what GTE's strategy is to deal with that, or if GTE is aware of that. I am sure, as a transnational company, they have their intelligence unit analyzing this, and they should be aware that this is the threat that is there. It has been issued. Everyone knows it. I mean, the paper boy that brings the news to me knows that if, you know, they sell the telephone company, something is going to happen. Lines are going to be cut. Something is going to be damaged. So they are going to deprogram computers. In fact, there was already an act of sabotage that affected two towns in the interior of the island. I think it was San Lorenzo and Juncos. I may be wrong. But there are already events happening that forecast what is going to happen. So GTE should ponder these things, and if they have a good strategy, I'm sure they'll go ahead. But if not, they should think about it.
Professor Emilio Pantojas is a sociologist and director of the Center for Caribbean Studies at the University of Puerto Rico. He's a regular contributor to Our Americas.
Los tecnócratas quieren vender de mi pueblo todo el patrimonio. No los dejes, despierta, boricua, mano dura contra esos demonios.
Los tecnócratas quieren vender de mi pueblo todo el patrimonio. No los dejes, despierta, boricua, mano dura contra esos demonios.
Son terribles aves de rapiña que se quieren enriquecer y se roban los bienes del pueblo, no le importa tu parecer. El bizcocho en Santa Catalina se reparten con mucha cizaña. Ellos hablan de infraestructura, pertenecen al gobierno araña.
And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. If you have any questions for us, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.
Los tecnócratas quieren vender de mi pueblo todo el patrimonio. No lo dejes, despierta, boricua, mano dura contra esos demonios.
Te hablan de un supertubo que del campo agua traerá. No les creas esas mentiras, eso nunca te resolverá. El problema de la sequía lo crean ellos en verdad, destruyendo los bosques y ríos y a la tierra le dan humedad.
Los tecnócratas quieren vender.